Welcome to a very special podcast. To kick off 2016, the teams from Cinemagog, Real World Theology, and Screenfish decided to join forces to discuss the biggest film of all time, Star Wars: The Force Awakens. During this conversation, we talk about everything from nostalgia all the way to sin and despair and the cycle of repentance. It is a supersized podcast that we're really excited about, so let's get right into it. Welcome to the conversation, because entertainment is not mindless.
So I might have mentioned this in the episode that we recorded, but I think the biggest surprise from The Force Awakens for me was the fact that I went into it actively ready to despise BB-8.
Really?
Oh, great. Obviously, like a toy grab. I get it. You're going to try to make him cute, JJ. Thanks. No thanks. I went in, and like in the first 5 minutes, I was like, I love BB-8 more than everything I've ever loved.
Dude, when he pops his little thumbs up, I've three times now, that has been the biggest. I mean, Han Solo can, Han Solo can take his fall. Like, no more audible reaction than his little thumbs up exchange. Like, that, oh, yeah. That's been it every time.
Every time. He's got so much more personality that is – it's like such a much – such a wider range than any, droid that we've seen to this point. You know, I know lots of people enjoy R2, but to me, R2 just kind of seemed like a useful curmudgeon. Like,
yeah.
Okay, no one gets it. I'll fix the situation. You're very kind of, I don't know, that's the personality he always portrayed to me. But BB-8 has like the sadness, the excitement, and it's almost like watching a child go in to watch Star Wars for the first time. That's BB-8. You know, JJ completely done what he does already. He recaptures that imagination and puts it in this little droid, and we love it.
I think you're right. There's a little bit of a difference there, a little bit more energy.
Still optimist versus pessimist. I mean, R2 is usually very sarcastic and kind of not as pessimistic as 3PO. By comparison, he looks like the more optimistic when he's next to 3PO. But ultimately, they're both they're both critical.
Yeah. Well, which is funny that we know that about R2, though he never says anything in English.
Yeah.
So I still think it's commendable that we could get a personality from a droid that speaks no human words.
Welcome, guys. This is exciting. it's neat for us to have Real World Theology and Cinemagog and Screenfish sort of come together to talk about one of the, well, I guess at this point, quickly becoming the biggest movie of all time. Is that fair to say? Financially.
Technically is,
at least in opening weekend.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know Real World Theology has already done a couple of podcasts on this one, and Cinemagog, do you guys have one coming, or
are you? No, we're not overachievers like you. Definitely underachievers. No, I do. I did a spoiler-free one about just kind of bringing Han's story full circle, but we'll have a full spoilery review up after the new year. Mm.
Well, and I would say, I wouldn't say we did multiple podcasts on it. We did one long, almost unending podcast because, people just like this movie so much that I basically just split it into two. And even then, so we have, almost 2.5 hours of listenable content out there just on The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
We still really only answered one or two questions, especially when we talk about theme or theology that kind of weaves its way into The Force Awakens. So, I mean, our second little piece was mostly just questions that listeners asked. We didn't even get a chance to dive into a whole lot of stuff, which is, I think, commendable for how much this movie really has. So I'm loving the chance to kind of specifically hitting on some of the key things that we didn't get a chance to talk about.
Yeah, I think this is an exciting one for us to do. Let's get into it. Let's start talking. We've come up with a few questions that we really want to wrestle with. Maybe just to start us off, one of the things I've been thinking about is the idea of nostalgia, because I know obviously at this point, and for the record, again, this podcast, we're going to go right gloves off, all spoilers all the time.
Well, I mean, if we can take the box office as an example, there should be very few people left planet Earth that have not seen this film at this point.
That's
so
fair. That's fair. Unless
they're showing it on Jakku, okay?
That's what that international gross is all about now, is interplanetary.
Mikey, we've talked before about, and one of the things you've said is 2015, you think it's going to be one of the biggest years, like significant years in film. I think I've heard you say that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I think we've seen a lot is this idea of nostalgia, not just in this film, but in several key films. Jurassic World, certainly. Again, Fast and the Furious 48 or whatever number they're on right now. You know, a lot.
Hey, I don't want to hit a single ounce of contempt in your voice for Fast and Furious.
I take it back. I swear. Which ironically is
don't forget Creed and Mad Max.
And Mad Max, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I can't make a joke about them being having so many Fast and the Furious movies when it's the same number as there are Rocky and Star Wars films now. Why do you think that nostalgia seems to be playing such an important role to us right now? And do you think it helps or hinders? I mean, we've heard that as a criticism lobbed at Force Awakens.
Well, I want to take the – having seen it three times now, I honestly think a lot of it stems because culturally – I've been able to teach on this here and then. We have sort of a new culture of narrative gluttony. We saw Star Wars, I think my wife saw Return of the Jedi like 11 times in the theater. But that's also because there wasn't as many choices.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have so many versions of Joseph Campbell's monomyth, and of course, theologically, I would tie that to other things. But their cycles are repeating Fast and Furious, if you might say, so much that it's getting impossible not to see it. I mean, we also have an internet culture that like records and teaches about all these tropes. So I think it's coming from a place of – it's hindering some people's enjoyment. I'm not certain that – it's ever. I mean, you go back and look at my eras and who looked back and loved this Western era that was so brief, but then the next generations, two or three, held on to this nostalgic view of it. It's fascinating now that the snake's eating its own tail, like where the nostalgia is for previous fictions. So it's different. I don't know if I have my finger entirely on it. I think it'll start to hinder people's enjoyment the more they sort of inevitably become. They're going to have to make a choice. When you see it, what do you do? Do you then do you keep complaining that there's nothing new, or do you sort of embrace that cycle? I don't know.
That's a choice, and I almost wanted this question to be called what we all like have been fighting on the internet about recently.
Right,
I would
right.
say mostly defending. Like, is The Force Awakens a new movie? Because that's what we're getting with. And I made this analogy with Creed. Creed is basically the first Rocky movie with a new lead.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing. And no one was like, well, it was like the first Rocky movie, so we hate it. But, you know, no one was expecting from Creed what they were expecting from The Force Awakens.
Yeah.
And even though people have more – anyone who's seen Creed, which is a minuscule of the amount of people compared to the people who have seen The Force Awakens, which is kind of sad because Creed's an excellent movie, that there wasn't as much cultural – hoopla or hoorah about it. So there weren't as many critics, you know, getting up there to get hits on their website by denouncing it as something unoriginal. And if you take that piece of this question out, because like I said, we could talk about that. We talked about it on our show. We've all talked about it on Facebook. There's so much out there. It's probably the biggest controversy quote out there about The Force Awakens, more so than all the great storylines that we could be talking about. But the nostalgia piece, when I saw this question from you, Steve, it actually made me how not only are our stories cyclical, which would be a defense of this movie not being just another version of A New Hope, but almost everything that we do in life is cyclical. Everything since the dawn of time, you know, someone has come to power. That power has gotten too big for its own, you know, own self. A culture becomes too comfortable and lazy and is unsustainable, and then collapses. And then from those ashes, another culture rises and does the same thing, and then crashes. And we, you know, see this over and over in history. And on the long term, on the short term, we see popular culture.
Mm.
So this is when. The three of us are wee lads, even though there's a little bit of age separating us. But for the most part, we're into most of the same things.
Yeah.
Our parents are buying us these toys. Our parents are taking us to these movies. We're enjoying them. But then we grow older. We go through the girl phase, the marriage phase, maybe even the kid phase. And then we come back around to the expendable income phase. And once we get to the expendable income phase, which is usually that, you know, 30 to 45 range, we get really nostalgic about the things that we enjoyed as kids that that kind of we automatically associate with fun and kind of that carefreeness. When we had more time to just have incredible imaginations about things, and we do have some nostalgia for these properties. I mean that's Star Wars.
Yeah.
That's for me, that's Rocky to a certain degree, even though Rocky films as a small child, but you know, that's that. That's not necessarily Fast and Furious, but it's Jurassic Park. It's all of this stuff. There's a piece of nostalgia in it, and there, and you know, Hollywood knows this. Hollywood knows that the male 30 to 45 market is going to, you know, jump to see these things that they loved as kids. So there's a bit of nostalgia, but I think you can't have the nostalgia conversation without talking about the piece that James is talking about, which is where is that balance?
Yeah.
Where is it? I'm watching this because, or I can't enjoy this because it's the same thing I've already seen, or I can't enjoy this because it's something that I love and I'm okay just loving things that I love. In Star Wars' case, I think there's a piece of nostalgia there, but I don't think the only people who are liking Star Wars are nostalgic freaks who are just going to love it no matter what, despite what some of those critics say.
Well, you know, I think the word hinder got me thinking. I mean, your question was how can it hinder a film? But I actually just Christmas Eve taught on we were doing a series on films, surprisingly, and I was talking about Nightmare Before Christmas. But I stumbled onto this quote by Lewis, and when we talk about nostalgia, there he sees it like a danger in one sense, and I think it's worth throwing out there. He says, I have the quote right handy. Speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find ourselves in even now, I feel a certain shyness. I'm almost committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each one of you, a secret which hurts so much you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia, romanticism, and adolescence.
Mm.
The books of music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trust to them.
Yeah.
It was not in them. It only came through them. And what came through them was longing. The more the hindrance is, we often have called Superman or Star Wars. These things are kind of new mythologies. The more they actually do build on top of one another and become a deep mythology, it's pretty easy to start missing that where the longing should really be based more and more. So the things that I love and the nostalgia it's playing off of, it's a nostalgia that is only feeding a thought that the previous was the actual sustenance. I think it could hinder some of the things that we actually, the way I speak through messages and things, the more it just builds as if it is nostalgia or a longing for itself. It becomes a little less applicable to the, hey, look at this. See how it mirrors this story. It dilutes a direct line to the gospel, I guess. I do see a hindrance in that. It's just like, you know, you think about the gods of you know, Greek culture and stuff. You have all of these things which, you know, maybe an apostle can use as a through line in one segment here or there. But you have entire cultures built on these mythologies, loving and passionate and dreaming of characters that don't exist. There's potential harm there.
Yeah, one of the things that I read online just after it came out or something about this very term is that they were saying that nostalgia is more about a feeling. And I thought that was an interesting way to think about it, because when we think about nostalgia, what we're trying to do is feel the way we did when we first experienced it. You know, that was the reason I really think that was the appeal of Jurassic World. You know, Jurassic World isn't all that different in some ways than this one. And I don't mean story-wise. I just mean the fact that they gave you things, story beats that were in the first film that everybody loved. And, you know, and it's self-aware. Like, that's the other thing that people aren't talking about. This film is very self-aware of what it's doing. Han even says at one point, how do we blow this thing up? That always works. There is a recognition that there's an intentional connection with the past, which it should have. And Jurassic World did a lot of the same things. They say, we planned for this eventuality. We knew this was going to happen because it always does. And one of the things I think about with nostalgia is very much this idea that you can get trapped in by your feelings about how you used to feel. So, for example, I grew up on the old movies. And then, you know, I'm not going to defend the prequels because, you know, we could discuss that. We're not talking about that today. The fact is with the prequels, you know, they didn't have any of that, we want to make you feel like you did as a child, sense to it. And this film is, you know, there's a good part of it. JJ wants to help you feel like you did before. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think that's a bad thing at all. I think it because they didn't just remake it. But I think where we get into trouble is we just yearn for the feeling we had when we were five, when we first saw New Hope. There is a lot of new things that this film brings. A lot of new things, even to the old characters. The old characters are new. They've gone through different things. Han and Leia talk about having lost a child, even though he hasn't died. He's not a Sith Lord. He's not even a Darth anything yet. That's another issue. We'll get to that, I'm sure. But, you know, there is new. And I think that's one of the things I was so nervous about this film beforehand. I remember, James, when we were doing Spectre, you asked me if I was super excited. And I said I was tempering my expectations because I was so afraid that my expectations would circumvent whether or not I'd be able to enjoy it. Because I think in some ways we've already written the story we want to see them tell. But
No, literally. I have an old story I wrote when I was 15.
Well, I'd say furthermore, they know that there should be, and well, at least I would argue there should be, and I think the producers, studio, whatever, whoever decided to pay like $1 billion for Lucasfilm, they know that there should be some nostalgia there.
Absolutely.
But you're not gonna keep people on nostalgia alone. So you need to add something to the universe that isn't just a two-dimensional picture of something, but you need something that has three dimensions, maybe even the fourth dimension. You know, you can almost smell it. You know, you can almost taste it. It has such substance. And so they went and picked out the person who does nostalgia better than any other director in Hollywood right now. And I've mentioned this before, and I think I may have even talked to James about this. Like, you know, J.J. Abrams is this new generation Steven Spielberg.
Yeah,
the way Spielberg could make a film and immerse you in a world and just make you feel like a little kid who never thought he would see these things happen or feel these emotions on film. JJ, while not necessarily creating a lot of original content, is really great at bringing in that emotion and making you feel like a little kid again. And not only in that little kid again way where I'm just seeing what I've seen before. It's, oh man, I am immersed in a world that is full of wonder and imagination, and I want to just sit and rest in this world for a while.
Yeah.
Good nostalgia, bad nostalgia. I think there was just the right amount in The Force Awakens, and I think it gets us thinking, it gets us enjoying the film, and, you know, kudos to JJ for ushering that in.
It's interesting because bringing in Rian Johnson for episode 8, I'm not anticipating much nostalgia at all. Not that he's not a big fan, but Rian Johnson's storytelling is he's a very different storyteller than JJ. I'm actually in some ways more excited now because knowing they've given me what I wanted, now where can they go? That I think is exciting.
Yeah, I think you're right about the clash of old and new. I mean, I love the effortless way without feeling forced or anyone pounding on the table. We just had a naturally great, strong female character. You know, yeah. I mean, just and a lot of people are discussing that. They also found a way to do it without denigrating the male. I mean, even just where like she doesn't want her hand held, but it didn't feel as though I'm not upset at Finn at that moment. He's trying to find himself too. He's struggling to go from being a killer to something that looks a little more heroic. And you have these characters sort of feeling their way toward what's right, which was – or, you know, toward their calling, I guess. And
buzzword.
And, yeah, exactly. You know, they're trying to feel their way there, and there wasn't a lot of judgment about that. It played its way out. You know, and sometimes in a film, it's like the only way you can have a strong female character is if she somehow – is if there's some denigration of the male or so it has to be verbalized. It's just so natural. And that isn't something we've really seen in a lot of Star Wars. We haven't really seen that in Star Wars. We haven't even seen little touches, things, little beautiful moments where like how she gets and makes the bread in her meal and just sort of there's the powdered bread that sort of springs up. I just add water and just the tiny notes that get added to this Star Wars world that are, you know, I'm sure somebody is going to be complaining about the science of it, but it's fantasy yeah. more than sci-fi. And there's a beauty to that, you know, the little bird pecking in the foreground, which there are these beautiful little moments that we haven't caught and aren't yeah. necessarily callbacks, like lightsabers shaking in the snow or other things that my friend just took her niece, who's 12, to see it. Hadn't seen any of the other films whatsoever. She thoroughly enjoyed it, even though she admitted there were places where people were laughing or exploding with some emotion that she didn't understand why. So I think there's two. Finally, unlike prequels, you have these two tracks that people can have, and that's where. So yeah, I think the nostalgia slice it slices that keen place, just the way a good adult or just the way a good Looney Tunes or Pixar film will somehow play to both adult and child audiences simultaneously. JJ knows how to lay in two tracks.
Mikey, you asked a great question. Let's start talking more specifically about the film itself. Since we've talked about, you know, nostalgia and going back, how can the First Order or the Empire fall into the same cycle over and over again, sin and despair, when it's all happened before with disastrous results? What do you guys think?
I feel like since I asked the question, James should have to answer it first.
For me, it's easy. I see, I mean, whether it's in a microcosm or the macro, I mean, we see the same drama playing itself out on, I mean, in the war zones of the human world right now. I mean, we don't have to go to a galaxy far, far away to see this, the same hatred, the same racism taking new forms, the, you know, popping up in a different continent. I mean, it seems like we have a global culture, but it isn't somehow teaching everybody to avoid the same mistakes of the past. Even just dealing as a pastor with somebody who has had a disastrous relationship fall apart, and, you know, lo and behold, now they're with a person who's just like that, and they're repeating the same mistake again and again. There's a difficulty in a corporate sense as humans and an individual where we just keep returning to the vomit because it's easier. Man, yeah, even in Star Wars, right? The dark side is always going to be, it's quicker, it's easier. Yeah. It's an easier way out to just fall in line and fall into a sense, you know, create an order at the expense of really who we are. I mean, the dehumanizing aspects that we see the Finns raised in, you know, it's just like, let's all have an order. Let's all have a direction. Let me to have somebody tell me how to live. Somebody give me my identity. It's so much easier to just fall in step with that. Say these same problems keep visiting again. I mean, we just put a different face on the villain, literally. And over the years in human history, I mean, no matter how much we want to think that we are learning from the past of, you know, the mistakes of history, there are things that keep repeating in our own backyard. So the terrorism is still there, and creating our own problems is still right there. I think that's, you know, one thing about the prequels, which was overbearing, but some of the politics and the Senate ideas and the way that the Republic gives over its power. I mean, these are things that we're struggling with right now. You know, as we look out at the landscape of Americana and going into an election year, like these are the fears and the different things everybody's talking about and playing off of. So, I mean, we've only been around a couple hundred years. It's not hard to think as our country is. A lot of people make comparisons to Rome and comparisons to Greek culture, and like this could just be the cycle turning again. Maybe it wouldn't turn so quickly as, you know. It's been 40 years. It seems like there's a lot of explaining to do in the Star Wars universe about how they got to where they were and now how it's been upended again. But but it's fantasy. Everything's escalated in a little bit speedier.
Yeah. Well, and that's the beauty of, I think, what Star Wars does, and I think our fantasy tales do, because in this one, the whole way I came to the question was trying to answer that, like, why do we see the same story told over and over?
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, why are the same stories told over and over again? Why are the same problems seen over and over again? And in a world that's not perfect, in a world that, at least from our theologies, is, you know, rife with sin and strife, where it's easier to worry about power and comfort than it is your neighbor, we're always going to come back to the same problems. And, you know, even in a galaxy far, far away, the screenwriters couldn't come up with a solution to where people weren't seduced by power. They didn't think that it would be easier just to do it themselves instead of being a servant first. I mean, like, our entire gospel tells us that we need to, you know, love our neighbor as ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, love God and love our neighbor as ourselves, which everybody's like, oh, that sounds great. But then people start to try to put that in practice, or I would, you know, I'd get into a hypothetical political, geopolitical, social order, you know, any kind of conversation, and you try to start applying that, and people always find excuses not to use it.
Yeah.
Oh, well, if you try to love your neighbor, well, they're just going to walk all over you. Well, if you try to, you know, love your neighbor, they're going to walk in with a gun in your house and shoot your entire family. Or if you try to love the terrorist, they're just going to kill you. And, you know, like, if you try to love a Democrat and you're a Republican, then they're just going to pass all their things and none of your things. And it's just, okay, well, if that happens, so what? So we do something that is not loving God and loving our neighbor. And then it just repeats that cycle. So especially when I see, like, how does the First Order, the Empire, or basically anyone ever continue to do the same things over and over? I think, you know, James kind of said this, whether on the micro or the macro, I think it's easy for us to see, you know, on the micro, like, I go, oh man, I said something that, you know, hurt my wife's feelings. I will never do that again. And, you know, that lasts for a day or so at best. You know, even under the most ideal circumstances, you know, we could be on a vacation where we don't have to worry about paying for anything. Everything's exactly what we want. And I will still say something hurtful because there's something inside me. So on the macro, the same thing happens. You know, I made this allusion before, you know, like at a certain point, an empire would get so big, it would care more about comfort and maintaining that comfort and power than it would about giving that power away and become unsustainable and fall. And which is why I think comparisons to like the Roman Empire are very apt for America, because right now we care about comfort more than loving our neighbor.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the same thing's true in the Star Wars universe. Even though it's a galaxy far, far away, it's a fantasy. It's, you know, we're claiming that it's not reality. But it has these truths that it can't get away from about human nature, about how we're made, and what people will seek after. And I think that's this wonderful truth that they're dancing all around.
Yeah.
And that people are rejecting because they're like, oh, we've heard it before. You know, I said this on our Real World Theology episode. You know, those critics who can't take a story being told again are the ones that would be the worst to have in like your Sunday school class when you're going through the Old Testament.
Yeah.
And you're talking about Israel, you know, turning from God and then being saved and then turning from God. And then it's like, I heard it, you know, over and over.
Yeah.
But yet we are Israel, or the world's Israel on the macro.
Or in the New Testament, the way, I mean, you know, Peter, just how many times does he miss the point in just a couple of years? I mean,
yeah.
How many times can he, how many times does he miss the point? How many times does he deny? How many times does, then why again does he need to get rebuked to his face later by Paul? You know, it's we keep doing these things.
And more than that, what happens so often too is we keep doing it, but the problem with it isn't ours. So, for example, what you see here, they're saying, okay, the Death Star looked like this. Well, this is the Star Killer, and it's 20 times the size, because you know why it didn't work? It was too small. That was the issue.
We were talking about that. I mean, but how is that any different? It's like we have these awesome Red Baron biplane fights in World War One. And then, so World War II, it's going to be way different.
Yeah.
We have jets on planes. I mean, oh, we need, how about a bigger bomb? How about one that's, you know, it's nuclear? You know, I mean, just like, this is all we do. We just, we make a bigger bomb. How it's completely, like, this is what, I can even see the pitch room meeting. No, this, we're building it into a planet. It'll have it'll be a more solid structure. Mm-hmm. You know, I can see this, I can see that happening. Like, it's not insane. It's actually, well, maybe it is, but.
Well, it's not insane in terms of illogical.
In that we do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's so funny because it just shows the we are so unwilling to take responsibility for our own actions. You know, we refuse as, you know, as individuals on micro and macro levels, as we've already talked about. One of the things we talk about with the youth, we talk about the difference between guilt and shame. You know, shame is like, man, everything sucks. Everything's bad. Guilt is saying we are doing something wrong. There's an ownership, and you just don't see it in, well, you don't see it in this film. Like, we don't do it in our own culture. We don't take responsibility for it, because then when you do, you can get to the root of the problem, you know, our own sin. The problem is always something else. And I think that's just what you see here. And even what Kylo says, I'm going to finish what you started. You know, he's trying to build something that didn't work before intentionally. You know, Vader, this didn't, you weren't able to complete this, but let me do it for you. I will carve my own name in the history books by doing it right, even though it was the fundamental issue is the problem itself. So there is this sort of lack of ownership.
We see Han kind of dodging. I mean, again, yeah. Right? He says we had to deal with our son's loss in our own way, and his way is going back to what he knows, which really isn't in any way. There's nothing efficacious about his return to his smuggling. And so he's gone back. I mean, he's literally kind of, even though he's willing to say, I mean, when he says in the film he accepted the truth, that's not something he just has realized. It's something that he's realized before. So he's kind of like that lapsed. He's that lapsed believer at that moment. I mean, like, things get hard, and he doesn't want to face up to – he doesn't want to take action in it. He doesn't want to face it. He just he retreats from his wife and any pursuit of his son into something that feels a little more comfortable and he can sort of hide in until he can't hide anymore. The calling of the other characters catches, you know, he's caught up in it once again, really.
Yeah, there's a big theme in this movie of running, and you see it in pretty much every character that I saw, the old characters and the new. Rey, who, you know, gets handed a lightsaber and says, I'm not doing that. You've got Han and Leia who are running from their hurts. You've got Luke who literally disappears into, you know, looks like Ireland. And you've got it just, and even, you know, you've got Finn who is running for the better reason, you know, running, from the First Order. But, you know, and having said that, James, you asked a great question. Is this a movie all about repentance, you know, turning from, turning to?
So since James asked this one,
it's
I
you.
Have to answer.
That's,
it for
it's
sure.
All you, Mikey. This is you.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be an imperfect, broad, sweeping statement for every character, but there is a lot of theme in this. And Steve, you actually hit on most of these individual kind of examples where it's characters who are all kind of running from something. And there is, to different levels of degree or definition of the word, some repentance happening in their life or their surroundings that turns them so they kind of have to face reality. Now, like, metaphorically, I think we can take that as something that we could use illusory kind of to repentance in our own belief system. And this one, it kind of comes off a little more like you just kind of need to face your fears or you need to be willing to kind of fight for what you believe in or not run from something that's hard. Because we do have Han who he says this thing where he's like, you know, we all kind of dealt with it in our own way. And I went back to doing the only thing I was good at. And then, you know, Leia's kind of like, well, you know, we all did that, because she went back to being like a general instead of maybe going on to hone her force powers and maybe doing something different than what she kind of grew up doing, being just a plain leader instead of maybe a Jedi servant. You know, Finn, his was more obvious. His was like, you have to run. You can't fight this. It's about my self-preservation. I kind of like some of you guys. You should come with me to preserve a little longer. Let's go hide at the edge of the universe, as if whatever evil is growing can't reach there, which I think would be a really good point that you can make, because some of us, when we have problems, we run from those issues. We think, well, if I could only move to another state, if I could go somewhere where no one knows my name and I could start over. Well, if there's things that are inside you, if there's things that kind of haunt you, they're going to haunt you in a new place or an old place. And you'll notice those same patterns start to happen. You'll build a community in a new place, and those same personality traits or hurts from your past or sins that you've developed will start to affect the community around you, and then you'll have the same issues. Like I said, this goes back to our cyclical issue. And not a perfect metaphor, but the beauty of what this film can kind of say is that sometimes you have to acknowledge that. You have to acknowledge first that you're running, which is where I really like that scene with Maz and Finn and Maz's castle, because she basically crawls across the table and is like, you're running. Stop pretending you're just running from things. Mm. It's not heroic. It's not beautiful. You're just a runner. And implied in that is there's not really anything good in running, because we see him basically become friends with a guy who never runs.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, Poe, who is the, I'm ready to jump in and tackle this thing headlong. And Poe is one of the only characters that we see for a while that fully believes in what his life is meant for, what his purpose is, and what and every action that he's doing. So he's confident, he's heroic, even in the face of Kylo Ren. He kind of has that roguish wit, you know.
Yeah.
You know, some of the best. Like, how do you open the movie with some of the best lines in the entire movie?
Finn already, he's got the running from part, right? He's got the turning from part down. He just doesn't know what he's turning to. He's not turning to the right thing. Rey is really more about letting go. Like, she's there is something. Maybe even that even goes back to nostalgia, right? I mean, like, she's confident. I cannot move or do anything. This old thing needs to come back. And Maz very much says, no, your way is forward. Finding family is forward. Finding your path. Finding your calling. Like, you can't wait for something. You're not just sort of waiting for this thing from your past to come back. And yeah, and Poe obviously doesn't really face any moral crisis. And I mean, that's not really the focus or point of his character. Han has his, obviously. But really, in to my mind, Kylo also repents. He faces his fears and repents, and it's completely in the wrong direction.
Oh, yes.
So for me, there's a great, you know, just repentance and like facing your fears and finding your calling and all these things. Like, you're right. In a vague way, that can work against the Christian message, because like, oh, well, just find your identity or find your call or find. No, they pretty much define that he's got a wrong one.
Yeah.
Like, and he literally repents of the seduction of the light side by killing his father. Right. Yeah. I mean, like, and there's even that weird line with Snoke where he says, you know, by your grace, I will not be seduced. Like,
yeah,
when you're looking at the villain of the piece and like you, your grace, I've been saved by your grace. Like, oh my gosh, like that's just so here you have a seductive savior and a character who's repenting, putting to death the old self. And it's like, oh, okay, apparently we need the right direction, or we just turn into expletive, you know?
Yeah. I think you guys have hit it. Kylo is such a fascinating character. I actually, you know, some people, we had a good laugh at Kylo and his sort of, you know, teenager outbursts in some ways, but
you've all found the emo Kylo Ren Twitter account, right?
Oh yes, yeah. It's fantastic. Okay.
Totally perfect.
But I mean, his character has in some ways more emotional depth than, well, actually any depth, more depth than any of the villains they've had, because even you could make a strong argument for Vader at the end, but for the most part, he's a killing machine in the first three movies. Like, it's in the last half of Return of the Jedi that all of a sudden it becomes more about, this is my son, and then things start to shift. But Kylo's already got the issues going through. So certainly, like, it's really interesting to think of this idea. You think of ideologies and just how he's fighting what everybody knows is good, because he can't bring himself to subscribe to that. Like you said, he says to, is it Snoke's? You know, by your grace, I won't be seduced. But seduced by good? Like, it's such a strange way to think about it. But from the alternate perspective, like, he wants to maintain the power that he's got there.
He wants to fulfill his mission.
And fulfill his mission, yeah. We haven't spoken much about Han. Let's go back to Han here for a minute, because does Han, like, Mikey, your other question, does Han's apparent conversion to the truth, speaking of, you know, repentance, affect his willingness to sacrifice himself for the hopeful redemption of his son? James, it's on you and me to go first.
That's right.
But you haven't had a chance to go first yet.
All right. Yeah, I thought this was a great question. I hadn't thought of it that way. I would suggest it does, because I think listening to Han now, Han is the opposite of how he, in some ways, although, you know, his same tendencies are there, his belief is totally different from when we first meet him in episode 4. He's a different guy. Now, he may be running from the hurt of his family, but he comes in as much as, in many ways, as a mentor because of what he's seen. And his conversion to the truth, his belief in the Force, when he talks to Leia about Kylo, you know, it's such a fascinating one of my favorite conversations the entire film, because there's so much there. And just to hear them say, you know, she says, well, I should never have sent him away, and that's when I lost you both. You know, we did all we could. I wish I could have done more, sort of conversation. Han has a higher investment in his son than he has had, I would say, in any other character, even Leia. Like, he doesn't take responsibility for Leia. Here, I see Han as he's a father, but Han takes responsibility for his son and tries to call him out. There's a hope, you know. It's not like he's talking to Kylo, and Kylo says, you know, almost what Vader says, you know, is too late for me. Han says, no, just come back with me. Come back with me. There's a belief that this isn't over. This doesn't have to be the way it is, because Han understands now that it doesn't have to be the way it is. He's seen it. He's seen change take place. But I have to believe that stems from his experience and understanding the way the world isn't as small as he once thought it was. There's a spiritual reality that he had never accepted in New Hope. I don't know, James.
I think a couple things that I would add. I think his conversion has, I don't think he could have done it without that. Like, at this point, he couldn't have walked out on that gangplank if he didn't believe that there was something holding himself. He's not going to save his son. You know, he knows he has to trust that there is a hopeful arc involved, that there is something guiding the course, which, of course, they don't go to God. They just go to something more nebulous. But he's at least accepted that. I think the spark, though, which I would say, you know, I can cognitively understand the truth of Christ, and I can also even have experienced some pretty amazing moments by his spirit. But you know what? On the one hand, I don't want to say it's not enough, but in almost no circumstance in life does God ever leave that as it being so necessary that is it in total in then how we live. And I think where Han's apparent conversion effect gives him that willingness, but I also think that the spark of that, honestly, I mean, we could hit the back on nostalgia, and we could even hit back on the cycle. He sees a girl and boy trying to get a robot with secret plans back. I think seeing the cycle repeat and seeing, you know, it's pretty easy when your son goes bad to just think that we're screwed. The generation is like everything's undone. But even as Kylo points out, she kind of feels like Solo is the flail. He could be the father she never had. He's looking at her and like that's now that it's the daughter or the child that he didn't have, like piloting the Falcon there with him. Like he gets to see a struggling but willing servant. And sometimes it's not that God isn't enough, but we're struggling in life. And even in Scripture, when Paul calls out encouraging, living human examples of servants, you know, if you can't imitate Christ, imitate me. And he sees some children that re-spark that. Oh, this is real. There's hope for my son because look at these two. And look at, you know, he sees a little bit of himself in Finn, and he says, wise up, women always know. He sees a little of himself in Finn. He sees a lot of both himself and I think he sees a combination of things in Rey. And I think that is that helpful add piece to when it's like, all right, there's hope for my son too. Like there's hope for these two, even as then they come around in the story, there's hope for my son. And so like that's the way the story in this, as well as like, yes, God, the truth of the gospel is powerful, transforms our hearts, but we still suffer and we still go back to our old ways and we lapse. And usually it's God puts inspirational peoples in our lives that sort of remind us to steer back. And I think that's where he's Han. He's not kind of like Ben, just assuming he's going to die, but, but he's willing to put himself on that place and hope against hope. In this case, he obviously won't get to see the change, and I don't know if we'll get one, but he has to hope against hope that it is possible and be willing to lay down.
Well,
I'm going to cry again.
Well, JJ says this is a generational story. I really love when they're on the Starkiller, they're in, you know, Hoth Part 2, or whatever you want to call it. And Finn says, what's your plan? And Finn has no plan. He says, I was a sanitations guy. And he says, well, how are you going to do it? And he says, we'll use the Force. And there's this great moment where Han goes, that's not how the Force works. And I thought, here's a guy who, you know, three movies ago says, I haven't seen anything that shows me around the world controlling everything, you know. He does this line, and now he's the one in a, like, you're right, he's not Ben, but he's saying that's not how this works, guys. There's a mentoring relationship that's taken place.
Transition from that, because I like that, because I think it shows that Han can be this character that is representative of, like I said, something I believe James has alluded to before, like the almost like the we use such terrible language for it, but like the backslidden Christian or something like that. The fallen away kind of person who says, well, I believe it, but it's not really working for me right now. And I would say that being confronted with all the things that James, you already pointed out, makes Han have to say, when directly asked, like, do you believe it? And he has to say, it's true. It's all true. And he kind of has this revelation that, like, well, I haven't been living like it's true. Mm. And so when he gets back and has this interaction with Leia, it immediately reminded me of this great article I read over on IO9. And I'm sure there's lots of places that have done something similar. But it basically talks about, like, the biggest differences between the book and the movie, The Force Awakens. Because there's things that are in the book that did not quite make it to the screen. And there's this conversation between Leia and Han that we didn't get. And it's Leia admitting she could feel the dark side's influence creeping into Ben.
Hmm.
And she thought that she was strong enough to protect him by herself. So much so that she tried to use what power she had to stop that influence. And then never told Han, because she says, I was afraid that your reactions would only drive him further to the dark side. So we have Han, who's left this situation because he assumed it was his fault that Ben turned.
Mm.
And so almost in shame, he's returned to the life that he was more comfortable in, thinking that every time that Leia looks at him, he's only reminding her of, like, his failure as a husband, as a father. And I think with that revelation, it would have been even a lot more powerful to say, like, it wasn't my fault. And the fact that there are external forces, you know, light and dark, that actually do weave themselves in this, you know, fantastical universe, kind of does. I think it was C.S. Lewis who kind of describes as, like, you know, viewing the world with windows that look out on eternity. You know, you kind of have the blinds pulled back, and you can see this world created in a different order than the way people around you tell it is. And once Han has this revelation, he can't no longer argue that light and dark are fighting.
Mm.
The dark side is the rough father, the failure, the bad side that's making him run. And he finally embraces truth and says, it doesn't matter what happens on this very cinematically perfect chasm, you know, bridge over this chasm, the right thing to do is to encourage the light side. I don't necessarily think he thinks it's going to cost him his life, but he doesn't care.
Yeah.
because he wants to be reunited from something he ran from. Because I feel like all he can really do is kind of be the light that he wants to see in the world or something terrible like that. Something pithy. The other thing from this article that I wanted to mention, and I think it's something that we couldn't really see because it's an internal emotion that we see or that we read about inside Ben Solo or Kylo Ren. It says, basically after he kills Han, it says, following through on the act ought to have made him stronger, but instead he found himself weakened. Except for getting shot by Chewie. Like, we don't necessarily see him weakened, but I think that right there is closer to the gospel than almost anything else we saw in the film, because that's like, this thing will bring me life. Like, killing Han, killing my father, who I hate for various reasons, will finally bring me life. And seeing only when he does that, seeing someone willing to sacrifice themselves, does it actually almost turn the spotlight back on ourselves. So whether the truth allowed Han to walk out there or not, I think we would be remiss if it didn't have some effect on Kylo Ren, even though there's lots of people who think, you know, Kylo doing that thing now, he's proven he's irredeemable. I think the most beautiful thing and the most gospel thing that we could see coming from this trilogy is he still is redeemed at the end after killing his father, which is what I hope we see, you know, to some degree.
And perhaps haunted by, if Han can't be a Force ghost, the fact that he's allegedly contracted for more than this one, you could at least have, he could be haunted by what if he's imagining great conversations with Granddad, apparently, they could give us some imaginings of the haunting. I have friends who wrestle with this, right? I have friends whose kids are growing up, and, you know, you can read in the Bible, right? You know, raise up a child in the way he should go, and he will not. It's like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. None of us are perfect. Like, how does that happen? I hope the seduction is subtle if they refer back to things. I hate to think they're going to pinion it on some, like, it can't just be because Han just always said, I know instead of I love you too. Mm-hmm. You know, it would just be nice if they show a fair upbringing, but the imperfect but still decent, and yet that seduction is there. Cause a lot of people wrestle with that, and it would be great. It would be more interesting to me to think that the seduction had to be extreme, and that he wasn't, you know, mistreated in turn. That feels like it would cheapen it to me. So I hope that they don't have neglectful, you know, super neglectful parents or some kind of explanations there. And yet no dad's perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, two kids can have different thoughts about the same father.
Now, here's an interesting thing just to throw out there. I was just thinking about this. We haven't discussed Luke, and I know that there isn't a lot of Luke and he doesn't have a line, but how do you think that affects the lives of those around? You know, I was thinking about Luke just not being there. And everyone's trying to find Luke. Luke doesn't want to be found. How do you think that impacts the lives of people like, you know, Han, Leia, or any of these other characters?
It certainly would help Han with his justification. And if Luke sort of, you know, goes into exile because he doesn't want to face it. I mean, our example, you know, if the Force user just sort of wanders off and disappears, if the guy who's sort of been that central heroic figure disappears, it's pretty easy for me to take my leave too. If we all have mentors or peer brothers we really respect, somebody goes off the pedestal, literally just disappears, it's pretty easy to justify your own walkout.
Well, I would say that it's pretty commendable that people haven't necessarily, or some people have not lost faith in the fact that Luke can help.
Yeah.
Despite him not being on the scene. He's been gone so long that some people think he's a myth.
Yeah.
Or they haven't seen the tangible effects, and, you know, hopefully you can hear my inflection to see that there's an illusion here too. You know, they haven't seen the tangible whatever of Luke being around.
Yeah.
So people are like, oh, why would you believe in Luke Skywalker? That's just a myth. It's so dumb to believe in the Force and all that magic, because I haven't personally seen it, or we haven't seen it for years. Where are these miracles? But there are still the devoted few who without tangibly seeing him, without being able to touch him or feel him, they know that he could still help. and they are devoted to him. You know, this is mostly Leia.
Yeah.
But her crusade to seek Luke, despite not knowing where he is, not knowing how to find him, is what kind of drives most of these good things. I mean, this whole movie is about finding a map to Luke.
Yeah.
It's not about fighting the First Order necessarily. It's not about, you know, building up the Republic. It's not about getting more ammunition for the rebels. It's about seeking Luke. And so without that kind of devotion to or belief that her brother could really come back to the world to fix things, then we wouldn't have the story at all.
Yeah,
that's really Leia's strength, and seemingly men like Poe are kind of inspired by or just as devoted.
Mm-hmm.
But you go back to Star Wars. She's the first wholly devoted rebel we really ever experience, and you know, completely devoted to the cause for all the right reasons. You know, Luke and Han sort of could stumble in their own ways, and she here again. She's inspired. Yeah, you know, Poe is devoted to like Luke Skywalker as the answer to our problems. There very much is, although he's obviously it seems like they're alluding to an idea that we're going to find a very flawed man. There is that iconic idea of, you know, we're not going to solve the problem by our own means. We need to seek kind of the ultimate and seek the, mm-hmm. the that ultimate hero. You know, the person of the saving son of the last trilogy. Like, he needs to come back for things to happen. There's some beautiful metaphor being played with there, which I don't think is a mistake. I don't think but Abrams or screenwriters, I mean, they all know the power of this, even if ultimately they would just write it off as another myth.
Yeah.
They recognize the power of it, even if, like Joseph Campbell, they're only willing to say it's part of a monomyth and not true. Not that there is a true myth, like C.S. Lewis would say.
Yeah, but because if they don't believe it, they can still look back through history and be like, think of like the greatest stories in history. They all have some piece of this puzzle.
I think this works not only in the film, but on a meta level too, because you have to pass the story on. The story is true, but like you said, it's reached the point of myth, right? Like the people are saying, wait, you're really Han Solo? Luke is a real guy. I've heard of these stories, and there's this idea that you have to continue to share, to tell the story of what has happened before. And you even look at scripture, and you know, talking about the importance of passing on the story of scripture to the next generation is so that they can be a part of something that's bigger than them. And you see it here, even just encompassed in the film itself. Again, going back to the idea of nostalgia, like the story has happened, and you tell the story again so that you can understand what's happening now. Recently, looking at Thomas and the days when Christ was coming back, or Christ had risen. And this idea that he said, well, I'm not going to believe until I touch his hand and touch the scars on his side. You know, I've heard the rumors. I've heard the stories. And I feel like we sort of see that here with Luke. There's a fear, but at the same time, there's for those that have experienced it and those that have been told, they're the ones looking and they're passing on to others.
Yeah, I think that's just it's interesting to see how characters react to kind of getting the news for the first time. Because I believe one of my favorite lines from the film was when Finn sees Han Solo and he says, you know, you can't be Han Solo. Han Solo's 10 foot tall and, you know, shoots fire from his eyes and bolts of lightning from his
head. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's go on to James's question here. Because James, you pointed out something that I hadn't thought of, the idea of narrative trios. So not just Han, Luke, and Leia, since we already talked about Han and Luke. But also other ones like Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, Jack, Will, and Elizabeth, Ray, Finn, and Poe. What do we think about the narrative trio, and why do we find it so compelling? I guess, Mikey, you or me.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think this is great. I just finished helping write a screenplay where this exact same thing was kind of our formula. Mm-hmm. You know, like hero, love interest, best friend. But I also think it goes back to you know, the Joseph Campbell stuff that James already alluded to. It gives you your everyman, you know, your hero, and it gives you something kind of to strive for. And it also gives you kind of your trickster, kind of your funny guy who's making jokes. It also allows us to put ourselves in the shoes of the main character of the story. You know, there's lots of talk about how one of the most perfect everymen in all of history is Luke in the original trilogy, because for most of the trilogy, like, he's just kind of reacting to things. Like, he doesn't have a lot of personal onus. Like, it's just us, like, using Luke as a vehicle to kind of carry ourselves through the story, being forced to go from place to place for much of, especially A New Hope. And then, I mean, he kind of is almost forced to do that through Empire, and less so as the trilogy goes on. But we also be like, okay, if I was in this, I would probably have something to strive for, or I would have my best friend with me. Like, how can I see me and my buds in this? It's like when we played Final Fantasy games, or like back in the day, anytime recently, ever, when I played Final Fantasy games, like, you can always change the names of your character, the characters, to, like, the people you know in real life. I think it allows us, it's another way of us to kind of transport ourselves into the story. And the question that it actually made me ask was, since I am probably woefully uneducated about, you know, the entire smattering of rom-coms that are out there, like, most of the examples that we have are all guys. There's a guy as, like, the hero. Like, are there movies where this formula is the same, where, like, there's a female and she has, like, maybe a male love interest and, like, a female best friend? Like, does this work for both sexes, or is it something that only appeals to men? That would be my part B question that I would throw back at James.
Because you assume I watch lots of rom-coms.
Well, just because I'm wondering if you think this, is something that can transcend gender.
Oh no, it totally does. I think, and that is, I mean, that does turn up quite a bit. If it is a romantic comedy and there's the gal, she usually does have her, or she's, you know, interested in some guy, and there's the girl best friend. Sometimes the girl best friend who's living it up the way she's repressed and not doing it. I'm trying to think of the name of the movie where it's actually a married gal, and so she's talking to the married gal as she's got fears of being married, and here you have this sort of comfortable, you know, wife. So you see that.
Oh, are we talking about Trainwreck?
No, I haven't seen that, so okay. No, I can't speak to that one. I think we see it everywhere, and I, you know, I think it definitely comes back to a Ben Kenobi where he tells Luke a line I don't necessarily like in a lot of ways, but I think it has some application when he says you're going to find a lot of things depending on your point of view. I think if you have two characters struggling together, whether it's just a guy and a gal, so mm-hmm. or whether it's two guys, if you're the viewer, you're going to take sides. You're going to pick one person is more right than the other. Mm-hmm. Well, you add a third and suddenly you have three points of view. It's not as easy to take sides, and you find yourself bouncing between them, right? I mean, you watch Star Wars, there are times back in the original New Hope, there are moments where you want them. Leia's like, this is important. Mm-hmm. Leia's about as important and the rebellion's important. At other times you're kind of with Luke, like, well, you're the everyman. And of course you want to be Han Solo. You kind of bounce between all three at various points. And you know, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy have often even been compared to the id ego and the super ego. So it doesn't even have to be three different people so much as three aspects of our own hearts and minds that are sort of bouncing through. So a screenwriter even thinking that through, you know, you've got the curmudgeon calling critique on everything. You've got the go-go confidence guy, and then you've got, you know, cold reason. See, all of us have those pieces. So oftentimes I think these three people represent three aspects of ourselves that we kind of want to be. And I can't help but wonder theologically, and this is where I will tread and drop it at the line of mystery. I don't imagine in any way that the Trinitarian God, that the triune God of the Bible he's never disharmonious, but I almost wonder if some of our fascination with these trios in a very subtle and unconscious way, like, it's beautiful when the three of them are working together. Is there something in us that is enamored by that? Because there is that mysterious, unknowable aspect of the three-in-one personage of God, and that has a narrative dynamic that is actually touches something deep and mysterious we can't grasp. And when it comes together in a great story, and you like the three achieve something together, I don't know. I almost wonder if there's something deep there that we can't quite put our fingers on.
You know, when you talk about Trinitarian theology, you look at a God that exists in community, And so often when we tell our own story, we talk about us, we talk about ourselves as individuals. You know, you talk about your spiritual journey, say, this is what God did for me. And we talk about it and we lose sight of the fact that we've been drawn into, grafted into a spiritual community, which God models himself in the Trinitarian. You know, you've got the Father, Son, Holy Spirit existing in perfect community. And then when we talk about it, it's like, you know, this is what God did for me, as opposed to for us, or we lose sight of that. And I think you're right. I think there's an imprint on us that just craves community. You know, when you look in Genesis, when God creates man and woman, he doesn't say, here's your wife. He says, it's not good for you to be alone. There's a community that's created. Yes, there's individuality, but we have this communal side. And I think it comes out in storytelling. You know, when you think about looking at the old trilogy, we talk about Luke, and then we talk about Han and Leia because they end up together. But really, it's a story of Luke, Han, and Leia together. It is their story, not just, you know, we talk about the hero's journey. Is it Luke's? Luke's a key part of it, but he's not the only one that's on a journey in those films and in these ones with Finn, Poe, and Rey.
It reminds me of, I believe it was a Tim Keller sermon I was listening to recently talking about community and how we experience faith and how often, especially in our current culture, a very individualistic culture, there's this idea that, like, you know, I don't need church, or I don't need this community because, like, I believe in God and that's good enough.
Yeah.
But because God is a communal God, he, you know, you are experiencing God in a way that, you know, I'm experiencing God in a way that James, you can't, or Steve, that you can't, and vice versa. So there are things that you understand on a certain level better about the creator of the universe better than I do. And we're made to see this big picture together, all looking at it in the same direction, not all sitting in our own room looking at it from different places. And I think the beauty of having a trio of characters, not only is it like easy to allude to the Trinity in general, but it brings those different perspectives that you mentioned, James. The curmudgeon, the practical, all these people are all the different ways that we can see a situation. And as an audience, we love when there are different perspectives and different ideas brought and looking at the larger painting through different eyes. So we can agree with some, we can disagree with others, we can kind of push back, or we can accept, or we can challenge, or just contemplate on, based on how different things interact with this one giant situation or picture. So I think the trio, because if you get much bigger than a trio and try to, you know, kind of cram it down to an hour and a half movie, then it's just going to be long. But you have
then you have a fellowship.
Well, I can say then you have like a Tarantino film or something wacky like that. So, you know, you get all these different perspectives, and I think that's the way it was meant to be seen. I think that's the way that people love to hear stories, where people are seeing the same thing through different lenses. Because, like I say, I would argue because that's the way we were created, not only to experience our faith, but, you know, in almost everything, because our faith is usually just something that we can stamp on almost everything else that we do in life, since everything is just pointing towards the Creator anyway.
Yeah.
Mic drop.
Yeah. Well, as you were talking there, it drove me. There's a book by James B. Torrance. I got a quote here. I wanted to throw it out here. Each individual has equal rights. Throughout, the dominating concept of God is, in practice at least, a Unitarian one. The counterpart of the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, the God who has his being in loving communion, is clearly very different. His primary purpose for humanity is filial. We have been created by God to find our true being in communion. Here, reason is understood, not statically or substantively, but dynamically and functionally. What is needed today is a better understanding of the person, not just as an individual, but as someone who finds his or her true being in communion with God and with others, the counterpart of a Trinitarian doctrine of God.
I think it was dumb.
That's fair. That's fair.
Not at all.
Okay, one last question here as we start to wrap up. We talk a little bit about this idea of belief. One thing I was thinking of when I was watching this film is there's also a distinct conversation between calling and belief. I was wondering, do you think that one necessarily comes before the other? This is my question, so you have to go first.
Oh, man.
I think belief sometimes precedes calling. I mean, recognizing something, because I'm not sure Finn has found his place.
Yeah.
I think he's still bouncing around, and he knows he's supposed to be alongside these folks. But he, you know, his saber outings were a little less than stellar. He's pretty good with a gun. Is he a guy that stays on the ship? You know, like which role does he have, or what role does he play ultimately in that longer space? Because in some aspects, I mean, even just practically, Rey fulfills both some Luke and Han aspects. So Finn's like, what am I, just comic relief? Like, what am I doing here? So, or am I just, you know, now great, now I'm in a coma. You know, I mean, just like what part does he play? Like, I'm not sure, like, he definitely believes, but yeah, he doesn't even, like, let's use the Force. You know, he doesn't really know what he's supposed to be doing yet.
Yeah.
So I think belief can come before calling, but so I think many times it's when your place comes a calling is many times then also where you're pulled inexorably into belief. You certainly can't. It's hard to imagine answering the calling apart from belief. I mean, it sort of comes simultaneously or in tandem. So sometimes belief can be embraced and you flounder for calling, but not vice versa.
Mm. How about I just stamp a ditto onto that?
Well, I think that's fair. I think, you know, I've been thinking about the title a lot with the film and this idea that there's been an awakening, you know, and Snoke's actually says that there's been an awakening. Something has changed. And you sort of look at these characters and all, I don't know if there's an easy answer. It's just what was wrestling with in my head, you know, because clearly Rey has a calling. There's very, very clear. And she's starting to open herself to that as the film ends. Kylo certainly is battling this call as well. And he already has a system of belief. So there is this interesting thing. I'm glad you brought up Finn, because Finn to me was an interesting case. He's clearly involved and believes something is there, but he has no idea where he fits in. All he wanted to do was get out of the First Order, and then all of a sudden he's, you know, in this thing, and he's helping bring down the First Order, or at least their weapon. And all he was doing beforehand was garbage, you know.
Nice. I like that. That works on so many levels.
What is the relationship between faith or calling and belief? And I think you're right. I think it's both. There's a both and. It's not an either or. Let's wrap this up here, guys. Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. Really great to have Cinemagogue and Real World Theology and Screenfish sort of come together on this one.
Ooh, it's a trio.
It is a trio. Oh, my goodness.
if it was just two of us, it would be kind of boring.
This was not in one of our questions, but I thought let's throw it out there as an ending. What would you guys like to see happen in episode 8? And I don't mean the grand narrative. Is there one thing you would like to see happen in terms of characters or story?
I don't know if there's anything. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything specific like I really want to see. I actually like not thinking about it too much.
Fair enough.
Maybe this is like a cop-out answer, but much like I saw the teaser trailer where you don't even get much of anything for Star Wars, I was like, going to go see it. Don't want to know anything about it. I want to be surprised. I love talking about theories, but not specific things that I'll see in a movie.
Fair enough. James?
Well, I think I alluded to it earlier, and I'll probably I'm sure I'll get schooled by some Star Wars fan who's now going to be convinced I'm an idiot. But if they've abandoned much of the expanded universe and it's no longer canon, I'd like to know what is canon about quote unquote Force ghosts. What is truly canon about the nature of that? Now, I'm not sure how it would align with trying to make my theological parallels to my favorite narrative, but who has ever said that the reason Ben or, you know, the people can show up, is it because of power that they have afterward? Or is it because people close to Luke or people Is it that it's related to the person that's still existing? If so, there's no reason that, like, Ben, like, literally, I mean, Han Solo could show up, and I would love to see the haunting of Kylo Ren. And maybe, I mean, everybody's still like, well, but Han wasn't a Force user. He can't come back as a ghost. Well, what if it's more about Kylo's strength in the Force and the ability for these things to, especially he's in the dark side. I'd love to see some, you know, Witch of Endor. Hey, Endor, sidetrack. That rebuke, the rebuking spirit, it would be fascinating to have that go on and have that be a component of his continued struggle. That's probably what I want to see most. I also kind of want to see Lando Calrissian. What happened to Lando? I mean, it's one character that maybe nobody else cares, but
yeah.
I would love to see his return, particularly if we're going to have lost the rogue character in his old age and been sacrificed. We got another ex-pirate, I'm just saying. So I'd love to see an appearance of him. Yeah, it would be – those are my two. See, I lean more toward the pirates, so I want to see him in the movie again.
let me say this real quick, then, because I did think of something I would like to see. I don't know how to do this without making it more like the prequels, but I would love to see more – not necessarily space battles, but time with the X-Wings or – something like that. Bring back the B wings, the A wings. I want to see kind of all of that in this new universe. I want to see lots more of Poe.
Just, dude, you got a whole alphabet. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Like K wings.
So I want to see more of that. I really love the way, the look and the feel of the X wings and how they flew in the Force Awakens, and the way that they really explored kind of like 3D space with the Millennium Falcon chase. I want to see more of that. So
One of the things I really want to see is the training of a Sith Lord. We've never really seen that. We've seen Anakin be seduced, but here at the end of the film, of course, they say Kylo's got to complete his training. We spent an entire film with Luke as he's trained by Yoda, but we've never seen what type of conversation goes on that, something, it's got to be something significant because Kylo's already conflicted. But I'm actually really interested to see what that looks like, or if they show it.
I can envision a parallel track, like back and forth between the two, between like Rey, and that could be a wondrous contrast to have sort of a back and forth in the next movie.
Montage.
We're back to Creed then.
Snoke, so he'll have to have his like magic tree moment, only like instead of like you like kill puppies or something on that.
What's in there? What do I bring? Everything. Bring everything. how can we connect with you guys? How can our listeners connect with each other? Mikey, James?
Cinemagog.com, if you can figure out how to spell it. You'll find my spoiler-rot review here up after the new year, because I figure everybody has to have seen it by then. Or, you know, whatever. Live on Tatooine. And then we'll have I have this brand-new pretty mic that looks like a Starkiller base. So we're going to be doing some podcasting after the new year, so watch for that.
Mikey?
Yeah, if you want to find me or Real World Theology, just go to realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. You can find basically everything we do. You can find links to the podcast. You could find us on iTunes or Feedburner or Stitcher, all those wonderful places. And if you want to annoy me with questions about how much about Star Wars I don't actually know, then please do that on Twitter. I'm at Fizzification.
That sounds good. And, of course, screenfish.net. We've got some great conversations going on. We've got our own podcast, too. The links are there. Or, you know, you can follow me on Twitter at Pastor Steve PBC. But thank you guys so much for joining us. And for all of you, we hope we'll have a chance to connect with you guys soon.
And may the Force be with you.
Always.
And also with you. Bye-bye.
Bye. was good.
Wait, so how is it that all three of us didn't talk about the elephant in the room?
What's that?
The fact that we all put out two questions to each other and did it in a numbered 1 and 2 format, and none of us used the same punctuation.
What? Did that happen? Oh, because my gosh, you're
like,
right.
I did, you know, very OCD, 1 dot space question. And then, you know, Steve, you went in for the, you know, the parentheses.
1 parentheses, yep, yep.
And then James was like, he was just keeping us on our toes. He used a dash and a period.